Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, Billie Jean is not my lover. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And that sound of disapproval is to the terrible quote that I chose to start this episode. We're talking about gene therapy.
I get the pun now.
Yeah. Right, Billie Jean therapy.
Okay, yeah.
So gene therapy, Billie Jean therapy is when you have to listen to Michael Jackson songs until you feel better.
But that's a good therapy.
It is a good therapy. I don't mind that at all.
It's the dancing cure.
Yeah. Now, gene therapy is something that has incredible potential, but definitely had a rocky start. And, you know, if you don't really know that much about DNA and genes or chromosomes, if all that confuses you, go back and listen. We recorded a podcast immediately before this one, should have published just before this podcast did, that goes into sort of gene 101. And so listen to that one so you can get caught up. We're going to be pushing on right now talking about gene therapy, which is an attempt to treat genetic diseases at the molecular level. So you're actually trying to address molecules that have some form of defective element to them and replace those with quote-unquote good molecules or good genes.
So a good point of distinction maybe to start with would be how is this different than all of the normal ways we fight diseases?
Well, a lot of the ways we fight diseases, there's, of course, ways where we just try and treat symptoms.
Right.
Where we're not actually addressing the underlying problem, possibly because there may not be a way of addressing right. the underlying problem.
Or you're just letting your body do the work a lot
exactly.
of the times maybe, and you're just trying to make yourself feel better while that happens.
For example, if you have a cold, there is no cure for the common cold, right? But there are lots of different ways you can treat your symptoms and try to manage symptoms to have different levels of efficacy depending upon whom you ask. But that's one way of doing it.
Or, for example, if you take an antibacterial medication to try to clear something out of your system, that's attacking those bacteria that are attacking your body in some way, shape, or form.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's another way where you're actually trying to fight off some sort of quote-unquote alien invasion, but yeah. alien in the sense of it doesn't belong inside of you.
Your body uses antibodies, right, mm-hmm. which are proteins that attack foreign cells.
Yep.
Or sometimes its own cells, depending on how your immune system is functioning.
Right.
Yeah.
There are cases where you have things like allergic reactions, where your body goes into overdrive trying to kill something that doesn't actually need to be killed. I speak from terrible, terrible experience. These are all normal or quote-unquote normal ways that we use to fight off illnesses. But some illnesses, genetic illnesses, have to do with actual information that's in our DNA that is defective. Genes that are encoded the wrong way and therefore are not producing the proper proteins the right way for certain processes. And there's lots of different types of genetic diseases that cover a wide range. So we're not going to go and talk about all of them because that alone would be a series of podcasts. But one common element here is that these diseases have these faulty genes at the very core of the problem. And if we were somehow able to remove the faulty genes from our cells and insert good, healthy genes in their place, we could end up possibly curing the disease.
Or if we could figure out how to turn on or off a gene that is doing the opposite thing.
Right. And keep in mind, genes, you know, we didn't talk about this in the last podcast, but it does bear saying it, I think. Genes are complicated, right? So, you know,
we didn't say that?
Well, in the sense,
I think we did.
In the sense of, like, if you think of genes like a switchboard, all right? Mm-hmm. So think about a switchboard where every single switch is connected to an LED light. So you've got a bank of LED lights and you've got a bank of switches. And when you turn on a switch, an LED light comes on. And then when you turn it off, the LED light goes off. If that's all genes were, we'd be set. That would be so easy to fix.
But what actually happens is you have to flip like 7 random switches all across the board to make the light come on.
Right. And if you
and
turn,
it also turns a few other lights on and it also makes a weird quacking noise.
Yeah. Right. We're back to the platypus. If you turn one switch off, maybe the quacking noise goes off and 3 of the lights go off, but then 5 more lights come on. It's so complex and it's within this net network of genes and how they all express themselves, keeping in mind that some genes can express themselves in multiple ways. That's why it's not so easy as just say, you know, turn that one switch
off. And then we push the button.
The word for what all of the genes produce together is the phenotype. That's sort of the external expression of when you've got all the switches switched on.
Mm-hmm. And so the goal of gene therapy is to address these faulty genes and to fix them in a way that is not harmful to the patient, which can also be very difficult because, again, it's really complex. Sometimes when you think you're fixing one thing, you might be actually creating a much larger problem or maybe just a different problem.
And I've got some really interesting examples that are terrifying about that.
Can't wait to get to that. So let's talk a little bit about mutations. You know, how do genes mutate in the first place? And there's actually quite a few ways. First of all, when you're talking about genes, you're talking about this data, essentially, that's encoded in DNA. And that data gets copied over and over and over again. During cellular division, you get copies of your DNA, and sometimes changes happen when these copies, sometimes mistakes are made. So to speak. So it's kind of like, you know, if you were to ever make a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy on a photocopier, you know, that final copy doesn't look as good as that original one. In a very basic way, that's kind of similar to what I'm talking about here. Also, environmental factors can cause changes to your genes. So
radiation.
Or even, you know, what chemicals are in the food you eat, the water you drink, or the other stuff that you drink. You know, all sorts of stuff. Things like stress can affect your genes mm-hmm. to some extent. So, you know, there are a lot of different factors here. It's very, very complex.
And most of those changes that are going to happen are going to happen in somatic cells, in your bodily cells, not in your sex chromosome cells that are passed on to, or your chromosomes, period, that are passed on to your children. That's epigenetics, and that's a whole different issue. But some of the changes can lead to, like we talked about in our stress
episode. Some of them can potentially be inherited. Whether or not that ends up expressing itself in offspring is another question. So one interesting thing I think about inherited genetic diseases is that, for the most part, they're recessive. So in order for you to have a full expression of a genetic disease, you have to have inherited two copies of the mutated gene to really inherit the disorder. When you think about it, this isn't that surprising, right? You wouldn't expect for most genetic diseases to be in dominant genes because in any species, because if it were a dominant expression, then those life forms, whatever creature you're talking about, most of them probably wouldn't get to an age where they could reproduce, and that gene would eventually phase its way out of the overall population. But if it's a recessive gene, then not that many, comparatively speaking, will display this or will express this gene, this trait, this whatever the genetic disease is, so it can actually continue to exist within a population longer than it would if it were a dominant gene. So that I thought was really interesting. But let's talk about kind of the history of gene therapy itself. So we've kind of defined why it could be potentially really helpful in the fields of medicine. It was back in 1972 when there was a paper that was authored by a pair, Friedman and Roblin, the pair wrote a paper called Gene Therapy for Human Genetic Disease? Because they were actually asking the question, could gene therapy potentially address this? And they proposed replacing defective DNA with good, quote-unquote, DNA. They also cited the first attempts at gene therapy experiments going back all the way to 1970. Now, this paper was written in 72. And in fact, other sources I saw said that the experiments that happened in the 70s and 80s were in large part unauthorized trials. Which that leads to some pretty serious setbacks in gene therapy. As when I get up into the 90s, I'll talk more about that. But gene therapy isn't as far along as it potentially could be, I think, in part because of some overenthusiastic but perhaps misguided trials. And so in 1985, labs that were in the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute and in the National Cancer Institute conducted experiments which showed cells from a patient with ADA deficiency, that's adenosine deaminase deficiency, which affects the immune system's ability to fight off infection, those could be corrected in a tissue culture using a retrovirus to insert corrected genes into the cells.
And this is actually still how they're mostly proposing to do gene therapy, right?
Well, it's one of the ways. Viruses have some issues, but viruses are really good at penetrating cells. I mean, that's what they do in order to replicate, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've said before that sometimes it makes more sense not to try and copy or outdo Mother Nature, but to just
use it.
Yeah, co-opt what Mother Nature's already doing, right? If you take a virus and you strip out all the stuff that makes it dangerous, essentially its ability to self-replicate and any other information that would otherwise alter your cells, and then put in the stuff you want to have injected into a cell, and then introduce that into the tissue or patient, then it does the work for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a perfect machine. A virus is a machine designed to inject DNA into foreign cells.
Right. Now, there are some problems. First of all, I mean, everyone's always worried about the idea of using viruses in the first place, especially they don't understand a lot about how viruses work. But it's also not ideal for every situation. For example, if you want to treat something that is found in brain tissue, a virus is a bad idea because viruses are too large to penetrate the blood-brain barrier. So you've got to find something that's even smaller than a virus, your typical virus, to be able to penetrate that barrier to deliver the good DNA to brain tissue.
They are developing, I think that they are currently developing some methods specifically with Parkinson's disease that,
yes,
that may use viruses, but
the main approach I've seen is using liposomes and creating essentially a plastic coating for liposomes that would allow it to move through the blood-brain barrier effortlessly compared to most viruses, which would not be able to penetrate it.
They're also playing with different kinds of viruses these days. I think originally retroviruses were what were being used, and these days lentiviruses are being used. Things like HIV, actually, that have a really long incubation period and can infect non-dividing cells.
Mm.
So it
interesting
winds up doing, but continue right with your timeline.
Back to the history. So we've got this retrovirus that was used in this early experiment in 1985. They showed that it could be done. In 1986, they began to experiment to introduce correct genes into bone marrow cells in animals to see how safe it would be as a treatment. So they're using the animal's actual bone marrow cells to deliver good, quote-unquote, DNA. And the conclusion was that it was safe, but they didn't get the correct gene to enough cells for it to be considered effective. So in other words, bone marrow just wasn't the right vector for delivering this kind of treatment. It worked, but not on a level that would have created enough change for it to be a good treatment. So in 1988, they try white blood cells instead of bone marrow cells, and that increased the number of cells that were affected. So they thought, aha, here, we're on to something. And in 1989, there was an experiment with tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, TIL cells, that showed that using a virus to insert DNA material would be a safe form of treatment. Now, this experiment was more about inserting a DNA marker into TIL cells. It wasn't about putting in good DNA. It was about identifying this cell as a TIL cell. But one of the other pieces of information they got was, oh, well, this could work for other applications beyond just marking a cell. We might be able to actually do gene therapy using this approach. So September 14th, 1990, the National Institutes of Health treated a 4-year-old girl with ADA deficiency. They also treated a 9-year-old girl with ADA deficiency. And this was one of the first approved trials for gene therapy. So this approach was not incredibly effective at first, although the last information I could find, both patients are leading normal lives now. They do not have this ADA deficiency apparently anymore, but the delivery methods have improved significantly since 1990. There was actually very few successes in early gene therapy experiments all the way through the 80s into the 90s, and that was one of the reasons why gene therapy had a real rough go in the early days, right? Not a big surprise. We're talking about something incredibly sophisticated that we have, admittedly, only a sliver of understanding. Like, there's so much we don't know about genes.
Right, and we hadn't mapped the human genome until 2003.
Right, so it's not a big surprise that it took a while, because we were still learning about what we were doing while we were doing it. In 1992, Dr. Claudio Bordenon of the Villa Salute San Rafael University in Milan experimented with gene therapy delivery systems using hematopoietic stem cells to deliver genes. So now we're trying other methods. The stem cells was another vector. In 1993, researchers used gene therapy to treat babies who had ADA deficiency. And moving up to 1999, this was a terrible year for gene therapy, and it was a terrible tragedy as well. So there have been a lot of trials, very few successes, but the entire discipline of gene therapy suffered a serious setback because there was a patient who was undergoing gene therapy to treat a liver disease at the University of Pennsylvania. That patient's name is Jesse Gelsinger. Jesse Gelsinger died during the trial, and it was the first death attributable to gene therapy. That led to increased scrutiny of gene therapy programs across the entire world, and a lot of conclusions were drawn that many, not all, but many of these trials did not follow terribly rigorous standards, or perhaps were not designed in the most ethical manner. The desire to try and be the first to have a working gene therapy might have been guiding people to act recklessly, particularly with the lives or well-being of patients. And it raised a lot of criticism about gene therapy in general. So even the people who were following very stringent, strict scientific processes and being as ethical as possible were brought under the microscope. And there were a lot of questions about when is it actually acceptable to move from the experimental stage where you're working on some isolated tissue or you're working with an animal, not a human being, and then move that to human trials. When is that actually an acceptable moment in gene therapy? And the whole thing kind of brought the discipline to a crawl for a couple of years. And there's still a lot of scrutiny there, obviously, because you know, this is potentially very useful, but also very dangerous type stuff. In 2002, researchers at Case Western Reserve University and Copernicus Therapeutics created the liposomes, there were 25 nanometers across. So a nanometer is 1/1,000,000th of a meter. 25 nanometers, that's incredibly tiny. And that they wanted to use to carry therapeutic DNA through pores in the nuclear membrane. And that same year, sickle cell disease was treated in mice using gene therapy for the first time and shown that that could be an effective treatment. 2003, the University of California used liposomes coated in polyethylene glycol. That's what I was talking about earlier, the PEG material, which that was determined to be a good vector for delivering gene therapy to the brain because, again, most viruses, not all, but most viruses are too large to penetrate the blood-brain barrier. And then in 2006, National Institutes of Health used gene therapy to treat melanoma and showed for the first time that gene therapy could be a viable treatment for cancer. Now, that's the history lesson. Let's talk about what's going on kind of around that time to more recent.
I want to stress that when I look at information about gene therapy, I still very often see phrases like last resort.
Oh, right. I think that usually these experiments and this research that's going on is on children with terrible fatal diseases.
Yes.
And so frequently it is a last resort.
Right. Yeah,
I just wanted to stress that.
Sure.
Despite the fact that we have moved past some of these early days, like, there's still a whole lot of caution about it.
And there should be. I mean, because again, there's still so much we don't understand that it needs to, we need to have caution, not only just to be ethical and safe and give the patient as good a chance at recovery or treatment as possible, but also just so we keep our own expectations in check and we don't sit there and think, oh, if I just change out this one little strand of information within this person's cells, everything's going to be fine. It's important to realize that there's so much we don't know that we have to proceed with caution, because until we know all that information, we could potentially do more harm than good in our treatment.
Yeah, one of the interesting studies I found was related to vaccines.
Yeah.
So Right. Right now, a vaccine is pretty much always preferable as the way to prevent somebody from contracting a disease.
Sure.
But what about in the case of a disease where we just can't get a reliable vaccine, like HIV? Now, the human immunodeficiency virus, it's difficult to create a vaccine because of the structure of the virus. Antibodies have to recognize elements on the external structure of a virus
in order to want to attack it.
Yeah, to recognize it and prevent it. But HIV is kind of stealth. It doesn't have those external structures.
Gotcha.
And so it's difficult to recognize. And so there's been all this difficulty creating a vaccine. But some recent research, especially some stuff published in Nature in 2011, found that, well, at least in a trial on mice, the immunodeficiency virus is susceptible to gene therapy that would prevent transmission. And so a gene therapy could be sort of like a preventative measure to keep you from contracting HIV. Of course, the trouble is, as with all these other cases we've been talking about, it's dangerous, basically.
Right. And there are other diseases and conditions where we have little to no treatment right now. Like, it may be that all we can do is treat some symptoms, but we can't treat anything that's underlying that. So everything from Parkinson's to Alzheimer's, these kind of...
A lot of blood-related genetic disorders.
Right. A lot of these different genetic disorders, we really have no way of treating anything beyond some symptoms in some cases. Like, in some, we don't even have ways of treating the symptoms necessarily.
Absolutely.
So that's one of those things that people are really looking at gene therapy as potentially being another attempt to treat something that otherwise we pretty much can only just try and increase the patient's comfort as much as possible because there's nothing else we can do. And those cases, I think, are the ones that are going to have the most attention directed at them for the near term for gene therapy.
Absolutely. I wanted to correct myself really quickly from earlier. Lentiviruses are a genus within the retrovirus family.
But their
specific properties are important.
Gotcha.
I was talking about them like they're two totally different things. That is an untruth right there.
I knew that. No, I didn't.
Yeah.
So in all these cases, and especially because the science is still pretty preliminary, we're talking about last resort. We're talking about it's still something we're not very sure about, and we would only use in cases where there's no other option, really.
Right.
But what if we got a lot better at it?
Sure, like to the point where we can actually treat these diseases.
Oh, yeah.
People can lead healthy lives. These genetic disorders become a thing of the past.
Yeah.
I see the future you're painting.
Right. So a future where gene therapy is just completely safe. It's run-of-the-mill. It's like vaccines are today. So, you know, your chance of having a problem is one in some huge number.
And we're having sporting stars cheating by having gene therapy to make their blood more oxygen absorbent.
Exactly. Oh,
whoa, guys, you're like totally. I was right there in the happy future where everybody was healthy, and now you're twisting it. What's going on?
Are you talking about gene doping?
Gene doping.
Tell me about gene doping, Lauren.
Well, gene doping doesn't exist right now. But what we're afraid could happen in some kind of terrible future is that, yes, that people would use gene therapy in order to, you know, do the same kind of things that medications are, that illegal medications in most sporting worlds are used for now.
Like the whole blood doping stuff.
Yeah, the phrase comes from blood doping, which is where, you draw your own blood and you keep that out and store it, let your body regenerate more to replace it. And then right before the big race, you shoot yourself back up with your blood. So you've got extra red blood cells. You can get even more oxygen to your muscles, you're Superman.
Yeah, relatively speaking.
Yeah, but what if instead of all that, you could alter your genes?
There's a gene called erythropoietin. I think I got that right, and Juan, we're going to go with it.
Awesome.
EPO, that regulates how many red blood cells are created in your body. And when it's functioning normally, it'll shut off when you've got enough. But if you wanted a few more in there to
boost
your oxygen,
athletic ability,
You know, unfortunately, in trials, it's difficult to get them to turn off once you've turned them on. And then you just
become like a blood sprinkler?
A crazy blood bag.
Wow.
Bad times.
I knew a crazy blood
bag. You'd be like a horny toad, just blood shooting out your eyes all the time.
Good times.
It was pretty tragic. And many, you know, many other things can go terribly wrong, which is why we're not doing this right now.
Well, but so gene doping. This paints it's a merger of the happy future we were talking about and this dystopian future. It's a future where you can mess with your genes.
Right.
You can just do stuff.
Right. So
like in BioShock, you can just, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're beyond the ability to do things like determine what color eyes your children are going to have or what sex your child will be.
Well, it would be that too.
Right.
But you can also shoot bees out of your arms.
I think you might be going a little too far.
Here we go. Here's where the X-Men come in.
Okay. All right. I knew we were going to get there. I knew we were going to get to the X-Men. But honestly, I mean, we are talking about the potential in the future. Let's say that we have perfected, as close as you can to perfecting anything anyway, some gene replacement therapy or gene alteration to the point where we can genetically modify human beings so that they are the best of the best. So before we get to X-Men territory, we're really talking about Khan, Noonien, and Song territory, Wrath of Khan type stuff. These are the people who were genetically engineered to be intelligent and strong. They were meant to be warriors to end up ending a conflict, and then once the conflict's over, what do they do next? Then we shoot them into space. So I mean, there's that future, but you're talking about even going beyond that. Let's say that that's even a possibility where we're able to make people the quote-unquote the best people they could be based upon the genetic information they carry inside them. You're talking about going even further than that and giving people abilities that are not even human, right?
Yeah, well, okay, so this raises a problem I have with the X-Men.
Okay, this is one problem you have with the X-Men, or this is the problem you have with the X-Men?
So the X-Men is the X-Men. It is right. What it is, you know.
Because I could go on about
blades that come out of my hands.
I could go on about Cable for hours.
Okay.
Oh, let's not talk about the Summers.
I can kind of see claws. I can kind of see it.
Like Santa Claus? Or?
No, claws.
Like adamantium. Kind of,
yeah. Oh, gotcha. All right.
Like, that wasn't actually a mutation, right?
No,
when
it
Wolverine
was not.
Got claws, but.
No. He has bone claws. They were coated in adamantium.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, his claws are actually bone.
Okay, we're good to go then.
When Magneto stripped him of all of his adamantium skeleton, his bone claws remained.
This is excellent. Okay. So I can actually kind of see claws. I mean, that seems like a long way off.
Yeah.
But it's within the realm of physical possibility. And that's the thing I want to make a distinction about. Actually, there are two things. One is physical possibility. I don't think Gambit makes any sense.
Well, he has that really thick Louisiana accent. It's really hard to understand what he's saying.
The problem with Gambit isn't that he has incredible powers. It's that the incredible power he has doesn't make sense in terms of physics.
Sure. Yeah, so you're saying that the ability to touch something and make it molecularly vibrate to the point where it explodes makes no sense.
Yeah, I don't see how that could ever be a property of the human body,
yeah,
no
how
matter
could you,
how different
how
your
could
DNA
you transfer
was.
That energy in such a way? Like, yeah, there's no mechanism for it.
Yeah, I would say probably the same thing about, like, shooting cold rays. I mean, that just seems it's not necessarily so much that it's a problem with DNA, it's a problem with physics. Like, how do you make rays of cold come out of your
body?
Right,
we do not have the, you know, genesis for laser beams to shoot out of our eyeballs, so therefore it's unlikely.
Or being able to control magnetism. I mean, yes, we all have an electric field. Living things create electric fields, and electric fields can affect magnets because the electromagnetic effect there, you know. But being able to control entire huge hunks of metal.
Bones I can see. Bone claws I can see. It would be very strange, but having weird bone claws that come out of your hand. Okay, that seems like a more physically acceptable. Or having an incredibly heightened immune system.
Sure. I was going to say Logan's other mutant power is regeneration.
Yeah.
And I can see how having an extremely quick working immune system would be a thing.
Well, yeah, most like mammals don't regenerate like that, but like reptiles can.
Sure.
Right. A lizard can grow
slower speed, but yeah.
Now we've talked about using things like gene therapy for regenerative medicine. So that kind of fits in with that.
Right. So I think this is that kind of thing is not so much beyond the realm of possibility. But the other thing I want to talk about with X-Men and genetics is this idea that all of these powers tend to be presented as if they're created by a single mutation.
Right. It's called the X gene within the canon.
Yeah.
It is a single gene, and depending on which bit of media of the X-Men you are consuming, sometimes it's an on or off option, which is not how
you
genes
can actually,
do.
You can actually be treated to a point where your mutant ability is turned off,
right?
As is seen in, I think, the third of the X-Men films that I never saw.
Oh.
But anyway, I mean, like, the idea that this one gene could have essentially unlimited expressions is kind of interesting.
I can see that by, say, either genetic engineering, so top-down control of your DNA sequence, or millions of years of evolution, maybe we could get bone claws that shoot out of our hands.
You don't think we're ever going to get to the point where we can teleport?
The bone claws, no.
Bamf.
But the bone claws that shoot out of your hand would not be one mutation.
Right, right.
The problem is, It's a misunderstanding of what mutations look like when they happen.
Sure.
A mutation doesn't cause a, like, complex, fully formed working apparatus that was not previously there. Mutations that turn into wings probably start as little tiny flaps.
Sure.
And have to be amplified over generations of success.
It more causes, your earlobe to be directly connected or a little bit floppy where it matches up with your head.
And
which is a great mutant power, but
floppy ear.
Floppy ear.
Yeah, that is a good one.
That was one of my favorite, like, eighth tier X-Men, floppy ear.
That was one of the lesser known powers of Omega Red. Yeah. He had floppy ear.
So anyway, getting back into this discussion, there's also a confusion about how mutations are passed on, and that if a mutation is passed on, it must therefore be beneficial to whatever creature has that mutation. But because we're talking about very complex systems, sometimes that mutation can go along with other traits that are advantageous. The mutation itself may or may not be. It might not be a problem, but it might not necessarily be advantageous. So it's not that, whatever creature currently exists in its, if you were to take a representative animal from any species and say, this is an example of all the traits that are the most advantageous for this animal because this animal's alive, therefore it has all the traits that were beneficial. That's facetious. It's not true at all. I mean,
no.
It's much more complicated than that. So when you hear about mutations and mutations being passed along, sometimes they are beneficial. And sometimes that's exactly the reason why the creatures that are alive now share that particular mutation. It's because it was one that gave them an advantage in whatever ecosystem they evolved in. But other ones, it's just they happen to piggyback on with traits that were very advantageous for survival, and that's why they too have survived those mutations. But it's complicated stuff. Like you said, it's not just one thing that manifests itself immediately in fully formed format. Things like birds now, we essentially understand to be the evolutionary descendant of dinosaurs.
They actually, they are dinosaurs, of the phylogenetic tree.
But it's one of those things where it took a long time for us to figure that out, right? It was like, we didn't have that understanding of that line of descent until relatively recently.
And now they think the T-Rex had feathers, don't they?
Yeah, a lot of dinosaurs had feathers. Yeah. Which totally changes my view of what dinosaurs should look like, based upon the way I learned about them when I was a kid. Of course, when I was a kid, it was shortly after the dinosaurs had died out. So
I feel like we've strayed a little bit.
We were
talking about X-Men in terms of
mutations.
Well, mutations and sort of top-down control of
mutations.
Yeah, sure. Maybe what the X gene does is set off a whole crazy, nuclear reaction of other changes in human DNA. So maybe that's what it does.
Like a domino effect, but not domino the character. We're actually talking about domino the little things that fall over.
Correct.
Okay. But to bring it back to the real world.
Yeah. X-Men's not the real world?
Yeah. So we're ruling out the shooting fire, shooting cold, stuff like that. But saying, okay, maybe you could have bone claws or whatever. is it ethical? Is it ethical to voluntarily mess with our genes if we have the power to do it?
It's a good question. I mean, it really all depends upon your definition of what ethics are, I think. I mean,
and also what messing with
Also whether or not the person who's getting messed with is doing so voluntarily. That clearly would have a huge impact. If it's, because if you're talking about, you know, making choices for an unborn child, then you are making determinations that are going to affect that child's life, and the child has no say in the matter. But then if you're leaving it all up to just biology, the child really doesn't have a say in the matter of what
they inherit either way. Right.
So is it better to leave it up to chance? Is it better to make determinations? And if it's better to make determinations, how far should that go?
I believe there was a court case relatively recently in the UK where one of the associations of the deaf got together and protested a bill that had gone through the government that said that certain kinds of genetic testing and certain kinds of genetic selection are okay. Like, for example, testing to make sure that your child is of hearing. And they were like, why can't deaf parents choose to have a deaf child?
Well, and to be fair, I mean, the deaf culture is a culture.
There is an entire
deaf community. And anyone who has not ever interacted with anyone who actually is part of the deaf community, just because you're deaf does not necessarily mean you are in the deaf community.
Right.
Right? But they have a very strong sense of identity. And they, you know, that's part of their culture. It's something that they value, and to discount it is pretty tough. I mean, that raises some pretty tough questions.
Yeah, if you have your own language, you've definitely got something going on.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and at a certain point, who is, you know, what kind of lawmaking bodies are allowed to
legislate that?
And at what point is it bad for people to decide
at what point do you have a government decide what it is that makes a person and then says anything that doesn't fit this definition isn't a person and therefore they don't get rights.
That's getting into terrifying Third Reich style.
Yeah.
Right. Well, what I was going to say is that all this makes me feel creepy. And one reason is that at the far end of the scale, I mean, we've all decided that eugenics is bad.
Yes.
But so how close is this to eugenics?
That's a good question. And I think one thing we can be thankful for right now is that we've got plenty of time to ask those questions and to come to some conclusions. Obviously, we can't draw any right now, or at least I'm not prepared to. Mm-hmm. This is a complicated issue that I think about that, you know, we're so far away right now, technologically speaking and medically speaking, that we've got time to have these discussions.
And just to be clear, we are in these ethical considerations, we're talking about voluntary changes. We're not talking about stuff you would need to save your life or whatever the case might be to cure a deadly disease.
Yeah, we're talking about things like being able to determine if your kid is going to have a genetic predisposition to being athletic, that sort of stuff, or, you know, even more subtle changes in influences in a child's genetic makeup. So again, we're not really there at this point, but it is conversations that are interesting and worth having.
Absolutely. Yeah, and working towards a point where we can use gene therapy to help cure diseases without also causing cancer on the side.
That would be good.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's always
preferable.
Good goal. Yeah. So, all right. Well, anyway, that kind of wraps up our conversation. We're probably going to talk a lot more about X-Men as soon as we sign off here. and possibly then move on to other pantheons within the Marvel universe. We'll see. But in the meantime, I suggest for all of you guys out there listening, if you want to be involved in our conversation, go to fwthinking.com. That's the website where we've got everything. The podcasts, the blog posts, the video series, links to other articles that talk about the same sort of concepts that we're talking about here that go into greater detail. You're going to find a lot of awesome information there. And we look forward to hearing from you. We will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.